Good morning. Turn your Bibles with me to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13. We're going to be studying there for a while this morning, thinking a bit about the complaining congregation of Israel in Numbers chapter 13. We've been studying a different chapter in the Scriptures, chapters that I think are life-changing, and certainly if we will apply them to our lives, they can be and will be. And I want to think with you about this one as we keep moving through the Scriptures in our studies on Sunday mornings. I want to start by telling you a little story. There was a monk that had joined a monastery, and he took a vow of silence. Years went by, and the monk never said a word. After the first 10 years, his superior called him in and he said, "Do you have anything to say?" And the monk replied with two words. He said, "Food bad." After 10 more years went by, the monk again had the opportunity to voice his thoughts. And so he said to his superior this time, "Bed hard." Another 10 years went by, and again he was called in before his superior, and when he was asked if he had anything to say, he responded, "I quit." And his boss said this, "It doesn't surprise me a bit. You've done nothing but complain ever since you got here." Maybe we can understand a complaint once every 10 years, but the simple truth is some seem to complain nearly every 10 seconds. It's a chronically contagious and a crippling condition. The pages of the Bible are not absent of complainers either. Complainers have been around for a long time, and we're expected to be admonished by their example and to change our lives accordingly. The classic example that the apostles often referred to were the complainers in Israel, who eventually became the murmurers in the wilderness. We may think of chronic complaining as one of those lightweight sins, not really as bad as some others, but the response of God to these cowardly and complaining people in Numbers chapters 13 and 14 paints a different picture for us. And so I want to take a look at it with you. I want to notice, first of all, what's going on here in Numbers chapter 13. And we begin to note that Moses commissions the people of Israel, specifically the spies in Israel, to go out, one man from each tribe, and to view Canaan's land. So I want to put this into its inspired context. Israel has just spent 400 years of bondage in Egypt. From basically the 1870s to the 1440s BC. 400 years they've been in bondage. But after the 10 plagues, after the crossing of the Red Sea, the Israelites make their exodus out of Egypt. They leave. They're on their way out. And that's good news. They're no longer in bondage. They're no longer being oppressed. They're no longer being taken advantage of by a Pharaoh who had turned from kind to oppressive. And so they leave Egypt, entering into the wilderness so that eventually they can enter into Canaan's land, the promised land that God had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the nation of Israel. After receiving the law, the Lord asks Moses to send 12 spies from Sinai into Canaan's land. Take a look at Numbers chapter 9 and then Numbers chapter 13. Here's where you read about it, and it's up on your screen. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, so this isn't Moses wanting to send out the spies. This is the Lord wanting these spies to go out. "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the people of Israel." So God says, "I've got a gift, and I want you to send a few people out there to check out the gift. I want them to see how wonderful it is, how nice it is. I want them to see the beauty and bounty of Canaan's land." So the real motive I want you to see behind spying out the land doesn't seem to be to deflate God's nation. That's not why God wanted them to go there. The real motive is to motivate them to see how wonderful a place God is giving to them, how wonderful it is that he's going to send them there. He wants them to see the beauty and the bounty of the landscape. Look at Numbers 13, and we're going to skip down to verse 17. It says, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. The previous verses are just a list of the individual from each tribe that's going to go. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said, go up this way to the south, go to the mountains, see what the land is like. Whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many. Whether the land they dwell in is good or bad. Whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds. Whether the land is rich or poor. Whether there are forests there or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Bring some food back. And now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes, the first fruits of the grapes. Now, imagine moving into a new land for free. For free. All you got to do is go there. With already developed gardens, there's already developed groves, there's already developed orchards, there's walled cities, there's pre-built houses, and God says, I'm going to give you the power and the strength to go there and to inhabit this new land and these new places and these new gardens and these houses that are already built, and I'm going to give it to you. It's yours. You've just got to go take it. It sounds like a pretty good deal to me. In other words, imagine how wonderful it would be to be in a prepared place for those who simply had faith in the Lord's plan. And I want you to see by thinking of it in that way, that this is not just a picture of Israel entering into Canaan's land. This is a picture of us as God's people and the hope that we have to enter into heaven one day. In John chapter 14, verses 1 through 6, this is what Jesus says to his disciples. His disciples, who would have to endure some conflict, who would certainly have troubles after Jesus left this earth, but Jesus says to them, let not your heart be troubled. Moses said, be of good courage. Jesus says, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. Have confidence in me. He says, in my Father's house there are many mansions, and if it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also, and where I go, you know, and the way you know. Jesus says, I'm going to prepare a wonderful place for you. It's going to be ready for you to inhabit. You've just got to live faithful to me throughout the rest of this life. That's all I ask of you. Put your faith in me, serve me, trust me, and I will get you there. I will give you this place that is prepared for you. Like Moses, Jesus then commissions his people to tell others of the great hope which lies ahead for those who will put their faith in the Son. Heaven is a prepared place for prepared people. And yet, here's how a lot of people act when it comes to heaven. A lot like the congregation of Israel sometimes. We see the obstacles rather than seeing the promise. And that's what we're going to notice as we keep on going through Numbers chapter 13 here. Even though there are wonderful things to enjoy in Canaan's land, we find that the 10 spies, 10 out of the 12, complain about it. Complain about it. It's just too tough. It's just too hard. The path is too difficult. And so you get to verse 26 in Numbers chapter 13. It says they departed, they came back, they had been there for 40 days, spying out the land. And it says that they came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran. And it says in verse 26, they showed them the fruit of the land. Moses said, hey, bring back some fruit. It was the time of ripe grapes. They brought back some fruit. So after a 40-day spy session, they come back, they report their findings. And they've seen evidence, verse 27 says, that indeed, this is not a bad land. This is a good place to be, a lot better than the desert that they were in at this time. So verse 27 says, they told him and said, we went to the land where you sent us. And it says, it truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Do you realize the fruit that they brought back? Not like the little tiny clusters of grapes that we find at the grocery store. You ever go to the grocery store and say, man, those are some big grapes. These grapes were so big, they took a rod One person held the rod on one shoulder, one held on the other shoulder, and they had to strap this cluster of grapes to the rod. Two men had to carry it. This was a place that was full of good fruit. It was rich in bounty. It was indeed a land with milk and honey. It was a great place to be. However, they also find out that when they go there, but there's going to be some obstacles. There's going to be some difficulties that we're going to have to face if we go into this land. And so verse 28 says, nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land, they're strong. The cities are fortified and they're large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. There's big people. Some of them are tall. It's kind of like how I imagine at the start of the preseason, a lot of times some of these big, tough basketball teams, they'll bring in some cupcake team to play against, you know, a D3 college or something like, no offense to any D3 college players, but the UK, okay, you got this lineup of all these guys that are 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", and the tallest player on the team they're playing is 6'3". And I imagine them getting off the bus and thinking, oh, boy, it's going to be ugly, but our college is going to make some money, so let's go play the game. That's how I imagine the situation here being like. They get out over there and they see, well, there's some nice things here. There's some good things, but the obstacles scared them. They're scared. In verse 28 and 29, you read about it. They talk about the Amalekites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites. There's all these different tribes there. And then you skip down to verse 32 and 33. It says, they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land. And it says, here's what they say, the land through which we have gone in as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. We might as well not even try. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. Okay? Now, keep in mind, this is what 10 people said. There was one. And, you know, I think those statistics are still very, very much like they are today. For every 10 complainers, there's one person that's positive. There's a lot more people complaining and moaning and whining than there are people who are saying, let's just go out and do this. Quit whining. Be confident. We can accomplish this. And so Caleb is the one guy, at least in verse chapter 13. We notice Joshua also shows up in chapter 14. Caleb is quieting the people and saying, shush, what are you guys whining for? We just carried a rod of grapes with two people. Why would you not want to go here? He quiets the people and he says, quit looking at all the negatives. Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men who had gone up said, we are not able to go up against the people. They're stronger than we are. Can't do this. Despite Caleb's enthusiasm to proceed with the mission, the men who had gone up give a bad report. They view themselves, notice there's two views here, they view themselves as too weak. They have a feeling of inferiority. We're not strong enough. We can't do this. They've already defeated themselves in their own mind. And they overestimate the enemy. So they view the enemy as superior already. They've lost the battle in their own head. We are too weak. The enemy is too great. It tends to make you wonder, and here's where the context is important here, but it tends to make you wonder if they'd already forgotten about how God had freed them from a powerful Pharaoh, where they were slaves, where God sent plague after plague after plague upon the nation of Egypt and upon the Pharaoh, and divided the waters of the Red Sea, drowned the entire army of the Egyptians. Had they already forgotten about that? Something that had just taken place days and weeks prior? And here they're saying, oh, the enemy's too big. Well, the enemy was too big back there too. And God was with you, and God helped you through it. In life, here's really the lesson for us. We often see two types of people. We see those who see the promise, and we see those who see the obstacles. Caleb saw the promise, And he was willing to get to work overcoming the obstacles to receive it. The 10 spies, they saw the obstacles. And they didn't do anything but complain and make excuses for how the blessings required too much sacrifice. Listen, if you've got a dream, if you've got something that you want to accomplish, quit making excuses. Quit killing yourself before you ever get started. Roll up your sleeves and get to work and accomplish it. Caleb and Joshua, they see the dream, they see the promise, and they act on it. Everybody else sees it, and they make excuses, and they quit. God wants you to see the dream, to see the promise, and God wants you to act and do something about it. Caleb was the only one who got his blessing. The rest, they stay in the wilderness. Listen, if all you do is see the dream and you never do anything about it, you're going to stay in the wilderness. You'll stay in your desperate and pathetic situation, always hoping you would have done something. Do something about what you want to do in life, if it's according to God's will, and accomplish it. That's maybe the lesson for us here. The rest of people stay there. So it is in life. We've got problems, obstacles to overcome. Yes, we do, but we've got to overcome them. Look at Acts 14, verse 22. So it is in life, and so it is in kingdom life. Acts 14, verse 22. One of the things that Paul and Barnabas do, which I think this is one of the things that we've got to do as preachers, it's also our work, is we've got to remind people there's a promise out there. And yes, you're going to have to go through some tribulations and some obstacles to get it, to get there. And that's what Paul and Barnabas did. They take one trip and they're evangelizing and they're bringing people to see the promise and to act upon it. And then they're going back after these people have tried to live the Christian life for a while and they face their fair share of discouragement and they've been downtrodden, they've been persecuted a little bit, and they're starting to second guess things. And this is what they come back and say: we must through many tribulations enter the kingdom of God. If you're going to get to the kingdom, if you're going to be part of it, you're going to have to face some trials and overcome them. You can't quit at the first sign of trouble. We know what Jesus said in the parable of the sower. There's four types of ground. And one of those types of ground is the ground where the seed falls on the stones. It springs up for just a minute, but then as soon as tribulations and troubles come, we quit. Jesus wants us to overcome the tribulations and the trials, not complain about them. Robert II, he once said this: complaining is a complete waste of one's energy. Those who complain the most accomplish the least. Those who complain the most accomplish the least. Is it any wonder? It seems like we're not accomplishing very much in our country these days. We've got a lot of people complaining and not enough people doing. Now, notice what this does. Notice the effect that this has upon the congregation. Moses is commissioning the people to go out and spy. We see that 10 have come back and they're complaining. And these 10 people, I want to remind you, in chapter 13, they were chief leaders of each tribe. So they were important. They were already looked up to by each tribe. And so when a leader of a tribe comes back and starts to tell his entire tribe the obstacles are too great, it very quickly discourages you. So you need to have some positive energy in those who are our leaders. Some people who say, yes, we can, not no, it can't be done. Need some people who believe and have some faith. But notice what this does to the rest of the congregation. Numbers chapter 14. I'm going to slide behind. Numbers chapter 14. Then all the congregation raised a loud cry. Notice the then. 10 people complain, and then all the congregation's complaining. It's a contagious thing, complaining. And unfortunately, complainers tend to multiply and congregate with one another, and this is the case with the wilderness whiners. All the congregation raises a loud cry, and the people wept that night, and all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey." Isn't it ironic that the little ones are the ones that actually get to the promised land? The very ones that they thought wouldn't get there and would get there and die our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? Are you really thinking about what you're saying? Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt and be slaves and be whipped by taskmasters and be treated with cruelty? And you're complaining in one sentence about your little ones dying, and it was the very Egyptian Pharaoh who was sentencing your young boys to be put to death. That's why Moses had to be rescued. But you want to go back to Egypt? Think about what you're saying here. They said, let us choose a leader and let us go back to Egypt. The cowardice of the ten leads to the crying of the multitude. Negativity and defeatist attitudes, what that leads to is a defeated people. Beyond that, the people's complaints become really exaggerated as the mass complaint session reaches this crescendo. And here's the things they're saying. Oh, I wish we were dead. You ever said something like that? Things are so bad, I just wish I was dead. I wish I would have died. Quit your exaggerating. Quit your little pity party and your pouting and saying things like that. They begin to think, oh, things were so much better back in Egypt. Things were so much better back in Egypt. Sometimes people say things like that, and then they don't really think about what they're saying. Things weren't better back in Egypt. They show zero confidence in their leaders, and here's what happens when we start complaining. Well, it must be the leader's fault, and we want new ones. If we get new leaders, we'll be fine. You know what that does? That basically takes all responsibility off of me. I'm not going to claim that I'm part of any of this. I'm not really going to be a part of it. All I'm going to do is, if we get a new leader, they'll take care of things. These are the contagious results of complainers. They look back to the good old days and they assume the past was always better. They can't imagine a bright future. They cast blame on their situation, on the leaders of their day. It's the president's fault. It's the mayor's fault. It's the principal's fault. It's the parents' fault. It's the teacher's fault. It's the coach's fault. It's the preacher's fault. It's the elder's fault. It's a special person who can say, it's my fault that I'm in this mess and I'm going to do something to change it. It's much easier to get a crowd together to blame everybody else and relieve ourselves of any responsibility for our desperate situation. And there's plenty of people getting crowds together these days, isn't there? Blaming everybody else. In the softball league that I used to coach in when Zoe and Hattie were playing, which thankfully I will never have to do that again, they have a sign. I've retired from softball coaching. They have a sign up, and it says this, because this is such a common problem in organizations. Everybody's complaining. We're complaining about the coach. By the way, people who coach for free. By the way, people who spend a lot of money a lot of times on buying stuff the team needs because they don't have enough resources for it. Coaches that have to volunteer to work the frying pan at the concession stand. Torture. Giving of their time. There's a sign up at the league that says, before you complain, have you volunteered yet? I think that's a great sign. Before you complain, what have you done to help? You're not volunteering your time. You're not coming in early, leaving late, picking up after the kids, using your own money. You just want to complain about those who are trying to do something. We speak of gridlock in politics. Well, that's what happens when people complain and offer no solutions. I want to ask you, do you really think God is pleased with complainers? You think God is watching from above saying, good job, you are sitting over there by the water cooler and you really blasted your boss to your coworkers. You got him. Good job. Proud of you, man. You think God's looking down while you're pounding the keyboard with that Facebook post or doing this? Man, that was a good Facebook blast. You got that guy. Good job. Way to complain about our government. You're awesome. Proud of you. Stamp your ticket to heaven now. You're in. The God is proud. We sit around the dinner table or the lunch after services and oh, you really roasted that preacher today, and you got him. That's right. He did go 5 minutes too long. You let everybody at the table know it. You let the waitress know it. We wouldn't have been late if our preacher wouldn't have talked so long. Good for you. Congratulations. You really got somewhere with that. It's contagious, though. And once one person starts complaining, everybody starts complaining, and we've gotten nowhere. Thankfully, we've got a good example to follow here, and it's the courage of the two people, the minority. The courage of the two. There were two people who saw confidence in God rather than complaining as the proper answer to their troubles. Notice verse 6. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, they tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, the land we passed through to spy out, it's a good land. This is what we need people to do. People who can see the positive here. Okay? Don't forget the promise. Don't forget what we're working for here. People need to see that in our marriages. Yeah, there's some obstacles, but staying together is such a better option than tearing it apart. Work to get there. Yeah, in a church, there's conflicts and there's issues and things that we have to work through. But man, a church that is unified is going to accomplish so much more in the end than churches that split and divide and argue and grumble and complain about each other. So let's see what we're really trying to work for here, winning other people to Christ, and let's work together to do it. We need people to see that in our country and people that are willing to work together to see some of the positives instead of always pointing out the negative. Joshua and Caleb do that. And people that do that with Christians. Christians who are wavering and who are weak and who are on the verge of backsliding and giving up and quitting. People to say, you know what? Heaven will surely be worth it all. And we need to sing that song, and it needs to be in our mind and our hearts. You keep on pushing through and trying and overcoming. It's going to be worth it all. Don't quit. Don't give up on your Lord. He's going to help you through it. And Joshua and Caleb were people like that. We need people like that in the church, in the world today. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and he will give it to us. It is a land which flows with milk and honey. Only, look, notice verse 9, don't rebel against the Lord. Do you know what complaining really is? Complaining are the first seeds of rebellion. It's rebellion. These two people, they have the courage to speak up to the congregation whose complaints are spiraling into this chaotic frenzy of overreaction. And Joshua and Caleb do what men need to do when negativity and despair take over. See the positives. Furthermore, they pin the problem on the people. On the people. So quit blaming your leaders. This is your fault. Not your leaders. It's not the obstacle's fault. The solution here is not quitting. The real problem here is that you have a lack of faith in God's goodness and power to guide. You don't have faith. The idea is if God calls you to do this, don't you think God is going to equip you to accomplish it? So your faithlessness is the problem. And they use another key word to describe it in verse 9 there. They say, don't rebel. Rebellion. That's what it is. Complaining is ultimately an act of rebellion against our situation. We don't like the situation that we're in. We're complaining about it. We're rebelling. And when we put complaining into the camp of rebellion, we can be better able to see why God took these complaints so seriously. When we complain about our president, by the way, don't get me wrong, it's not like there aren't things that perhaps need to be corrected with any governmental leader. They're not perfect. But complaining doesn't really do much about it. When we complain about our president, we're sowing the seeds of rebellion against his authority. When we complain about our coach, we're sowing the seeds of rebellion on our team to the coach's leadership. And you get one cancerous rebel on a team who complains to everybody else, and you've got a team that is often in conflict, on conflict and acting in defiance to their coach. When We complain about our parents. We're sowing the seeds of rebellion. Kids, when you're complaining about your parents, don't like their rules, don't like their authority, you're being rebellious. And we're living in opposition to the roles God gave your parents, which was to lead you and to guide you. When we complain about our preachers or elders, we're planting those first germinating seeds of opposition, and those will eventually result in division. The complaints of Israel were the first forms of propaganda to rebel against Moses. You know, one of the biggest warning signs to me in the church and with Christians is just when people start complaining. When people start complaining all the time, when they're always complaining, you better watch out, because it means that they're on the road to backsliding, they're on the road to rebellion, and they're about to cause division. The church needs more Joshuas and Calebs who roll up their sleeves and get to work, and less of the 10 cowards who run their mouths and just quit. Lesson is this: if you see a problem, there's nothing wrong with noting it, by the way. What are you going to do to be part of the solution? Joshua and Caleb are realistic. Yeah, there are some big people there. There are some things that we're going to have to face. There are some issues that are going to have to be overcome. But let's do something about it. You see and think, okay, the church needs to evangelize more. Okay, I'm with you. I'm all about evangelizing more. Let's do it. What's your plan? How can we accomplish this? We need to be more hospitable. We need to see more hospitality amongst the church. And individuals need to get together and spend more time with each other. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Who have you had at your home lately? Who have you invited out to have lunch with lately? What are you going to do about it? We need to utilize our technology better. You know, there's a lot better websites and people who are doing more stuff with technology. Okay, what are you going to do about it? And I appreciate the fact we've got a couple guys here that have been working really hard to update technology so that we can get the word out and use the technology that we have today better. How can you help? Not just complaining, doing something about it, courageously acting, doing something. Well, one last thing, and that is we need to see the condemnation of the Lord against those who were doing all this complaining. The Lord reacts very strongly to his people. Here's what he says in verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people reject me?" That's an important question. Complaining is a rejection of authority. By the way, these people thought they were rejecting Moses and Aaron, and the Lord says, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Why? Because I put Moses and Aaron in that spot. I wanted them to lead, and therefore I want you to submit to their leadership. Your rejection of Moses and Aaron, Israel, was not just a rejection of Moses and Aaron, it's a rejection of God himself. How long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them. I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. Do we expect the Lord to be pleased when we rebel against those who are in positions of authority? Do we think that he turns a blind eye to the rebellion and the rejection of his will because we faithlessly fail to believe he has the power to help us overcome all obstacles? He sees. He sees the complaints. He sees the rebellion. He sees the rejection. And God here does something about it. In verse 28, he says in chapter 14, "As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness. All of you who are numbered, according to your entire number, from 20 years old and above." Everybody over the age of 20, he says, you're going to wither and die for the next 40 years out here in the wilderness. One day, or 1 year for every day that they spent spying out the land. The people who will get to enter the land, verse 30 says, were Caleb and Joshua. Verse 31, "Your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised." God isn't pleased. God doesn't ignore the situation either, but he punishes the people of Israel for the rejection and their complaints. They are banished from the promised land for 40 years. In an act of compassion, we see the condemnation. I want you to see both sides of God here. God does see those who disobey his will, but God also sees those who do his will and who honor him. And so he sees that Joshua and Caleb were defending him. They were outnumbered, but he knows them. I'm encouraged when I read passages like 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19. Sometimes we feel like we're in the minority in serving God, especially in the culture that we live in today, where we do see an air of godlessness. But keep in mind this. We need to keep speaking up and speaking out, and God knows who you are if you're doing that. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are his. And let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. Lord knows who you are. He knew who Joshua and Caleb were. He knew that this wasn't to be blamed on the children under 20, the young children in the camp. It was to be blamed on the adults who all gathered together and in faithless rejection of God's will, rejected his plan. There is a lesson here for God's people today, and that is this, that faithfulness will not escape the notice of God, and neither will faithlessness. Those who are punished eternally include, if you read Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8, those who are punished eternally include the cowardly and the unbelieving. If you're faithless and you cowardly don't do anything about what God wants you to do something about in your life, it says you will burn in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. You're right there with liars, fornicators, murderers. God doesn't see the sin of complaining any differently than he sees other sins. The lesson is for us, true faith doesn't complain when it's handed a cross. It looks ahead to the reward and carries the cross until the obstacle is conquered. So Christians, quit complaining. This isn't just an Old Testament example that we read and we forget about and think, well, that's good advice. This is something that is repeated several times in your New Testaments. We read in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 5, Paul, as he writes to Corinth, he says, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased. Most of who? They were overthrown in the wilderness. These people that we just read about. Paul's teaching the New Testament church a lesson about Old Testament Israel. He says, we must not put Christ to the test. That's what you do when you complain. I wonder if Christ notices. He does. He says, don't put him to the test. As some of them did, and they were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Don't complain. Don't grumble. Don't be like those people that we read about. Be people who are positive and confident and conquer the obstacles ahead. Paul again writes to Philippi. He says, do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. We are in the middle of a crooked and twisted generation, that's for sure. People who complain and gripe and grumble and dispute and argue and always are fighting. He says, don't be like that. Do all that God calls you to do without complaining and grumbling and disputing and bickering. Shine as lights in the world. You will be different if you're not a complainer. You will shine. And then notice Hebrews chapter 3, where Rick read to us earlier, verse 15. As it is said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. The New Testament calls what happened in the wilderness rebellion. This goes back to Numbers 13 and 14. Several times, New Testament writers go back to this example. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not all those who left Egypt led by Moses? By the way, he's speaking to the Hebrew people here. People who had left their prior belief system and had believed in Jesus. So they have escaped sin by turning to the sacrifice of Jesus. Their sins have been forgiven, and they're thinking about going back to their prior belief system. And so he uses a comparison here. With whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? To whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see they were unable to enter the promised land because of unbelief. And therefore, he teaches a lesson to these New Testament Christians. While the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. Encouraging them to quit complaining, quit rebelling, quit thinking about going back. Let me notice one more passage with you in the New Testament. It's a passage in Matthew 20 where Christians are disputing with each other, the disciples specifically. And you read about it here in verse 24. When the 10 heard it, here's what they heard. The mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, she comes up to Jesus and she says, hey, can you put one of my kids on your right hand and one of my kids on your left hand? I want them to have positions of power and authority in your kingdom. And of course, Jesus says, are they going to drink the cup that I drink? Are they going to be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? The idea is, are they willing to suffer? Are they willing to face the trials and the obstacles and the difficulties that I'm going to face when I go to the cross? And so he says, I don't have the right to put them in those types of positions. Well, it makes the other disciples mad. Who do you think you are? You're trying to get promoted in the kingdom. You think you're better than us? And they are displeased with the two brothers. The 10 disciples are displeased with the two. They're fighting and bickering. And Jesus calls them all together, which is what needs to happen when bickering and complaining is happening. We need to have a little conference. And Jesus says this, you know the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them. Those who are great exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Nobody gets to be appointed great for no reason. You want to be great? Here's what he says. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. You want to be great? Serve. Whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Imagine the scene. You've got 12 disciples bickering. Jesus steps in and squashes it. He says his greatness is not going to be determined by a popularity vote. It's not determined by ordination. You want to be great, roll up your sleeves and get to work. And Jesus basically says, look at me and look at what I've been doing. I didn't come here and just claim greatness. Hey guys, I'm the Son of God. Everybody believe in me. Jesus came here and he went to work. Jesus came to earth, he served and he served and he served until his final act of service ended on a cross. When you serve others, you don't need to proclaim your own greatness because other people will notice when you serve. And they will give you the praise that you deserve. And most importantly, God sees it. Because we know God saw his Son and raised him from the dead, we know that God sees those who are living in the image of his Son, and he will raise them too. As we conclude this lesson, I want you to take a step back and see the big picture of what's being foreshadowed by this wilderness episode. Moses commissioned Israel to go into Canaan's land to enjoy God's blessings there. Yet they were met with obstacles and foes which would need defeated. Some complained and quit. A couple had courage and tried to convince. And ultimately, the complainers never entered into God's promises. They were rejected from receiving the blessing. And the big picture is this. Jesus commissions us to teach a lost world and to live in confidence that we will receive the promise. Some will complain the cross is too hard to bear. The burdens are too great. The obstacles and trials are too difficult. But others live in faith, and they are far-sighted enough to overcome the short-term difficulties. We can complain about our lot, or we can live courageously in anticipation of the prize. Which type of person will you be? Like the two or like the 10? Those 10 died in the wilderness. The two, Joshua and Caleb, 40 years later, they would lead Israel into the promised land and they would conquer their foes with a courage which had not been dissipated and with a conviction that God would grant the victory. Which type of person will you be as you go out and live your life? If you're someone who's ready to live your life of faith in Jesus, the one who overcame death, the greatest obstacle of all, why don't you just roll up your sleeves now while you get ready to get into the waters of baptism, confess your faith in him, and start living a life of service to him? That opportunity is yours. You'll come together, come forward.